Welcome to episode 40 for July 3rd, 2007. We're going to kick things right off with our top six list because we're so excited about it. We're going to give it the spotlight, and it's our top six unknown movies, movies we've each really loved and for whatever reason don't know anybody else who's really seen them. I mean, people just don't know about them or something. Our trivia question is going to be related to the Marx Brothers, and we'll also be getting to the Marx Brothers at the end of the show, too, just talk about the series there. But right in the middle, we're going to have Stephen continue his talk about ratings and censorship. My name is Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller, and I like to just tell our listeners, if they notice, maybe this podcast seems a little bit slower than normal, or there's some creaking or squeaking along the joints, that it's probably just because, well, we've hit 40, and the show might be going a little bit over the hill. But I think the old girl's still got a lot of life left in her, but, you know, be a little easy on us if things aren't quite the way they used to be. With today's top six list, we're going to expand on something we normally try and do, which is give you a list of movies to see if you haven't seen them. But we want to really focus on that today by giving you a list of six movies that we really love that most people, just for whatever reason, haven't heard of. And when we mean most people, we don't just mean, you know, average filmgoers. We also mean that these are movies that, just for whatever reason, they don't have a ton of critical backing behind them. They're not making those, you know, best of lists usually. These are just great movies that are underappreciated by just about everyone. Well, I'm going to kick it off with my number six pick, which is a little movie called Mumford, a weird name. It's a 1999 film by director Lawrence Kasdan, who I actually think is also an underrated director. But it's a weird little quirky comedy that kind of predates a lot of the quirky comedies that we're seeing these days, sort of maybe the similar vein. But it's about a psychologist in a small town, sort of that, you know, usual small town thing where everyone's involved in everyone else's business. But here there are some interesting twists and turns, and it's tough for me to really sell you on the general idea of the movie because it would be kind of a spoiler. Part of the real charm of the movie is figuring out where it's going as it's happening. You wouldn't expect a quirky little comedy like this to have as many and interesting twists as it does, but it's just got a really good sort of sarcastic but still sweet tone and some sharp performances as well.
You know what? I actually considered Mumford for this list. Nobody's heard of it, and I really liked it. It was quirky, it was different, it was funny. My number six is a British comedy from the early 60s. Well, 1960 exactly, in fact. And it's called Make Mine Mink. And it's this great caper kind of comedy where everything is very fast-paced, everything goes wrong. It's a bunch of thieves that aren't very good get on this idea of stealing mink coats because they get left around in subways and taxis and stuff like that all the time. So, and then, of course, their plans escalate, and they try more daring capers after that. But, yeah, a bunch of really inept people hanging out. And it, actually, now that I think about it, it reminds me a little bit of The Lady Killers if that movie didn't have villains that were real villains. They just had some buffoons that got together and decided it was a really good idea to start stealing mink coats, and they do try to hide it from the landlady, but very British sensibility to this, but very outrageous too. You know, there's the type of British comedy that's so subtle you miss it, and the other kind that's outrageous and crazy, and this is sort of an interesting mix of the two.
Yeah, and I can say truthfully that I have not heard of it, so good pick. Well, my number five is a movie that Sam actually turned me on to and that I've been fond of ever since. I think we were just talking one day. I was like, man, I was really bored. I want to rent a movie, and I didn't have anything in mind. And Sam said, well, you know, you like thrillers. Check out this movie called Mute Witness from 1994 by a director called Anthony Walker. And wow, I was just blown away because it looks like a crappy movie from the video box. It makes it just look like a kind of standard lame thriller, but it takes place on a movie set, which first of all is interesting, and it's about this woman who is mute, who witnesses a murder sort of taking place, and then, you know, she's, you know, how can you call someone and say, hey, I just saw something, when you're trapped in like this abandoned movie studio overnight? You know, she can't escape. The killers know she saw it. They're trying to get her. She's trying to get away. And, you know, it's that irony. There's that the phones work and everything. There's that usual cliche in thriller movies where, you know, the phone gets cut or whatever. But here she just can't make use of a telephone. And it's just really clever as it goes along. And there's something really creepy about a thriller in which, you know, the heroine can't even scream. She can't make a sound at all. It just goes some interesting places. My only thing I will say is that an early sequence, the actual murder that she witnesses, is, I think Sam said this too, is just unnecessarily brutal. It's kind of off-putting how violent it is for the otherwise, which is just a standard thriller. But yeah, really good movie and a lot of fun, except for that one opening, not so nice part.
Yeah, I agree with everything. Well, first of all, the opening scene itself is hilarious. Just absolutely hilarious before you really know what's going on. And then it gets into the more thriller angle of it, and the humor starts to be downplayed. But it doesn't take itself too seriously, so I guess you could say it retains its sense of humor in that sense. But yeah, I love those over-the-top thriller-type things. It's hard to know what makes them work and what makes others not work. I haven't quite figured out how to identify that difference, but this one definitely works. All right, my number five. Well, Danny Kaye is not really an unknown actor, and there's a lot of movies, Knock on Wood, The Court Jester, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, that people like, and it's almost their own genre, because he has obviously a similar comedic style to himself, and so that's replicated in a lot of different movies. So basically, you take Danny Kaye and you put him in Robin Hood, and you got The Court Jester, and you put him somewhere else, and you have this other thing. And so a lot of them are quite popular, but there's one that I've never heard people mention, and I think it's the best one, and it's called Wonder Man from 1945. Danny Kaye plays this dual role where he's this really super naive bookworm in one character, and the other character is his brother, and that's why they look alike. His twin brother, who's this outrageous party guy, playboy, gets involved with gangsters, and well, anyway, he ends up getting killed, and so his ghost comes back. This would have been a good pick for the ghost movies, I guess. And he tries to call on his brother to solve his own murder and take care of everything for him. And, of course, there's a double love interest, and they all mistake. There's a mistaken identity between the two characters. And so, you know, anyway, most of the movie is this really bookish, bookworm-type character getting involved with gangsters and not really knowing what's going on, played for just, you know, whatever can get a laugh, they go for it. And you know what? Lots of times these old comedies break up into musical numbers every once in a while just to break up the comedy, and that's not always a welcome thing. Here, they're fantastic, so you got the best of both worlds.
Interesting. Wonder Man, is that a prequel to Wonder Woman?
Just about.
Okay. My number four pick is Spartan from 2004, and no, it is not a prequel to 300. It's directed and written by David Mamet, and it stars Val Kilmer as some kind of special forces guy who has to get back the kidnapped daughter of the vice president. And I just love this movie because it's not at all a traditional action movie, but unfortunately it really didn't make any money, and it hasn't really had much critical reaction, and just no one really seemed to take notice of it after it was released. I remember I saw it on opening night just because I'm a huge David Mamet fan. I saw it with a friend of mine, and there were only two other people in the theater, and that's bad news on a Friday night, and both of them walked out about 30 minutes into it. The thing is, my friend and I just loved
it.
We were glued. I know. We started laughing because we just thought it was a great flick, but it's really understated and kind of strange, and it goes so many unexpected ways. There's a real cliche in action movies where the hero seems to always know what's going to happen. One of the things I like about Spartan is that the Val Kilmer character keeps making these plans, and then almost immediately they go wrong, and he's just improvising. And it's just, it's cool to see a guy who can act like that, and it's smart and effective, and ooh, I just love everything about it.
Yeah, I think you definitely liked it more than I did. However, I really did like it also. And yeah, it just kind of disappeared. It's David Mamet, you know? You think that name would be enough to at least gather the cult following that usually is attracted to his movies. But, well, my number four is The Unsuspected from 1947. It's a great old-fashioned mystery from director Michael Curtiz, who was the director of Casablanca, and he has this really great visual style, really loves to play with shadows and complex lighting patterns and everything, and that really adds a lot of atmosphere to the intrigue type of movies and gangster movies that he specializes in. But this is a murder mystery. complicated with all kinds of other interesting mysteries about who the people are. Usually, you know, in mysteries, you at least know who the hero is, and maybe the other characters are suspect. In this one, you really don't know who everybody is and who to root for and what their real relationships with each other are, because you get the sense that, okay, a lot of times they're putting on a show for other people and working a con, maybe, or maybe they just have this secret that they want to keep buried, and so they're secretive about who they are for that reason. But it's interesting, because as each mystery gets revealed, suddenly, you know, the solution, once you know really what's going on there, you get these really intriguing possibilities posed on how the other mysteries will play out. And so all these different interlocked stories kind of draw energy from each other. And it really creates an interesting story. You just have no idea where it's going to go. A number of great actors in it. Who really stands out, though, is Claude Rains, who's pretty much always good in anything, always adds to, especially this type of movie where you have mysterious characters in some kind of plot. And you know, there's interesting thriller elements as well. So, good movie. But, you know, I'd never heard of it. I saw it on TCM, I think, one evening, and I didn't know what it was, but I liked the pedigree, and so I watched it. And I'm like, why haven't I heard this before? This is great.
Well, yeah, that sounds just fascinating. I will say your list is definitely, as I expected it to be, full of random movies from all over the place, because I don't know where you see half these movies, Sam, but it never fails to amaze me how you have all these just completely unheard-of movies from the 40s and the 50s especially. Just always impressive. I'm having a lot of fun listening to your picks. Mine are generally a little more recent, because that's, I think, well, I have more experience watching newer movies. And, in fact, my number three is also a fairly new movie. Perhaps part of the reason it's unknown here is because it's a foreign film, but also I just feel like this is a movie that had the potential to be a lot bigger than it was, and I was kind of disappointed when it seemed to kind of fade away rather quickly. It's a movie called Cachet from 2005 by director Michael Haneke. It's a French film, and Haneke is sort of he's a cult following here and abroad, but definitely, you know, pretty marginalized, I think. And it's just a wonderfully intriguing movie. The basic premise is this upper-class French family, sort of upper-middle class. They one day receive in the mail a videotape that just shows the outside of their house for several hours on end. And that's pretty creepy, and these videotapes keep coming, and they can see where the camera clearly would be, but every time they go out and look for it, they can't find anyone there, no one's videotaping it, and they keep getting more and more tapes, and it's at night, and they see all this stuff, and they see these tapes following them around, and, you know, they go to the police, and they say, what's going on, you know, do something, and the police say, well, there's nothing illegal about videotaping the outside of your house, whoever's sending these tapes aren't threatening you, and then they keep getting more and more tapes that seem to have more information, and the movie does not play out like a conventional thriller at all, despite you could imagine that a conventional thriller might play this way. It has some elements, actually, of a David Lynch movie. Lost Highway has a kind of similar setup with, you know, this guy getting mysterious tapes of his house, but you know, the two movies could not be more dissimilar. And in fact, the movie Cachet gets really interesting. I don't want to say anything about it because it's a big spoiler, but really worth watching if the idea is intriguing to you. It's kind of an intellectual film and not what you're expecting, but really, really interesting and really deep, and left me just thinking about it for weeks at a time. I remember one time, right after it came out on DVD, I saw just sort of an aside, I think a funny story. I saw somebody renting it at the video store, and I said, oh, hey, that's a great flick. Yeah, you're gonna enjoy that. And as they brought it up to the counter, the guy at the video store goes, oh, you know that movie's subtitled, right? And so they decided that they did, in fact, not want to rent it, and a little piece of me died.
Oh. it's painful. All movie pain. Okay, well, I've been meaning to see that. I haven't yet. I got to stop meaning to and actually do it. It sounds great. My number three, okay, well, another one of those. In fact, my next two are these really obscure 40s movies, but this one, another British movie. It's called The Captive Heart, and it's a series of interlocking stories that takes place in a German prisoner of war camp during World War II. And a number of really compelling stories here. It is mostly dramatic rather than being, you know, I don't know, comedic or action-oriented. But in one story in particular really stands out for me, and it's where a man assumes this identity of another soldier who has been killed. And he does this, I mean, sort of complicated, but he does this in order to escape to England. But to do so, he pretty much has to carry on a charade to difficult extremes, because it starts really playing with other people's lives. I mean, he's got people back home that don't know he's dead, and he has to actually correspond with them, including his estranged wife, you know. There's, yeah, he just really brings a lot of questions of morality into play here. Is it really, I mean, yeah, sure, do anything to the enemy to get out of there, I suppose, but what happens when you're hurting your fellow countrymen to try to get out of a prisoner of war camp during war? It's another really interesting study about how war really messes with people's lives. I think the movies are pretty well suited to do that sort of thing. So The Captive Heart from 1946, this would be right after the war ended, so it would be very relevant for audiences of the day, but certainly still has themes that speak to today as well, pretty universal themes there. So good movie, I recommend it if you can find it.
All right, well, is it available on DVD?
No, it's not on DVD yet.
Oh, well, that's a shame, yeah.
So you got to catch it on TV or something.
It's really a shame how much... many of these films just aren't available.
Yeah, and it's weird because we get re-release and re-releases and re-releases of, I don't know, Casablanca or The Big Sleep or whatever, and it's great to have those movies treated well, but let's have some more diverse attention.
Absolutely. Well, my number two flick is something that you have heard of if you're a listener to All Movie Talk, because I have just been championing the heck out of it ever since I first saw it. And it's a film from 2004 called Primer by Shane Carruth. Talked about it before. It's a science fiction film about two guys who invent a device in their garage and how the device just completely alters their relationship. It's clever. It's intriguing. It's a great puzzle. And it just has a whole lot to say about human relationships, which is the way that the best science fiction works. It was made on a shoestring budget, but it looks like it cost a lot more. You know, it doesn't look great, but for a sci-fi film to be made for $7,000 is really impressive and just a fantastic film. You can listen to me talk about it if you listen to our older top six lists. So I don't want to say too much more about it, but if I haven't convinced you yet, let me just take one more shot at trying to get you to go out and rent this.
You should rent it. And Stephen, thank you for turning me on to this movie. That one was one I sort of aware of it just because I kind of read a lot of reviews and everything, but it kind of dropped off the radar pretty quick. And then you said, well, hey, you should watch this. And so I thought, huh, I vaguely remember that. Yeah, I'll go check it out. And I was really impressed. Then, of course, I had to go on the internet to find out what it meant, but it was still a really good movie. All right, well, my number two, not just an obscure movie, an obscure star. Really weird. Do you know Deanna Durbin? Does that name even ring a bell, Stephen?
Oh, not really. It sounds like vaguely familiar, but I don't know.
Yeah. I had never heard of her until a few years ago now, but relatively recently in my study of movies, I guess. But she's made a lot of great movies. There's a box set that came out a few years back, and I watched a bunch of these. There's a movie called Three Smart Girls and 100 Men and a Girl and Lady on a Train. A bunch of these movies, they're almost all really, really good. And so how come this star, Deanna Durbin, hasn't survived? I mean, she is an old-fashioned performer, a singer of old-fashioned type of music, so maybe she's just fallen out of favor, but the movies are really good. And my favorite one is from 1941 called It Started with Eve. I think I've mentioned it in passing before on the show, but the idea is, you know, it's a pretty standard romantic comedy type of thing where you have this man whose father is dying, and his father, all he basically wants is for his son to be married off, and so he hires this hat check girl to pose as his fiance and, you know, make his dying father happy in his last days. So, you know, it's a pretty standard kind of contrived situation, but it's played really well because this movie actually listens and is observant to the way people really behave. They really get that down. It's very light. It's very funny. The old father is played by none other than Charles Laughton, and he can add spunk to anything. It's just you could watch him doing anything, and it would be just riveting to watch. But he has some great grumpy old man kind of moments and comic moments, and he starts to get to know this young girl better than his son does, and they have a really interesting relationship that's not really often explored in the movies, that type of relationship. So I love the movie. I don't know why people don't talk about it.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know either. I guess that's the whole point of this list. Well, my number one is It's something of a classic in some circles. You will hear it talked about, but far less than I think it deserves. And it's a wonderful film from 1980 by director Richard Rush called The Stuntman.
Good one.
It stars Peter O'Toole as the director of this film. I guess the actual star is Richard Railsback playing this Vietnam veteran who's gotten some trouble with the law and comes back. And you know, you can tell it's sort of a 70s flick because, you know, this guy who's been a little messed up by the Vietnam War and gets a job working for O'Toole's movie as a stuntman. And it's all about the way in which sort of O'Toole screws with this guy's head as they go through this movie. And you start wondering, you know, is Peter O'Toole trying to kill this guy? The film has just suffered a loss. One of their stuntmen got killed, which is why he's able to grab Railsback and give him a job. But you're really wondering, is O'Toole trying to get another guy killed just because it makes for better filming? Is O'Toole just not care if his stunt people get killed because it makes the stunts more interesting and exciting? And it has a lot to say about society at the time and also all about the movies. I mean, if you want a movie that's really about directors, here you go. I mean, Peter O'Toole is basically a surrogate for God here. The most memorable thing from the movie is that O'Toole spends most of the picture on this giant crane just swooping around, coming in and out of shots. really, really clever, wonderful film. I just cannot understand why it gets left off so often. It was actually nominated for 3 Oscars, so at the time it had some recognition, but it didn't win any, and I just think it's kind of fallen off of most critics' radars, and I'm not sure why.
Maybe it's just so... It's just this real amalgamation of different tones and quirkiness and everything. Maybe just a lot of people don't get what it's trying to do. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, you'd think there's lots of movies from the 70s that are kind of like that. And that's why we embrace them so much. But I don't know. This movie came a little too late.
Well, I love the movie. I think it's got a lot to say about Hollywood, how Hollywood works. For some reason, these Hollywood satires are just really, just ridiculously funny. Maybe it's just we are familiar with the movies and we know that we understand the truth behind it. But yeah, I want to have a crane in my house so I can do the stuff like that, swoop in and out on people as they're having private conversations. All right, well, I wonder if these movies are more known in Britain, though. You'd think The Stuntman and a couple of mine are British, and maybe they have more respect in Britain and not so much awareness here. My number one might fall into that category, and it's called The Wrong Box from 1966. All right, well, here's the setup. An account is established. It's called a tontine, where you have a bunch of money put in an account for these 12 children by their parents and rich relatives or whoever. And basically, it stays there until 11 of them die, and the last one left alive gets the full sum of money. Well, the decades pass. This is right in the beginning. We see a bunch of clips of different people in later years dying, meeting their demise in strange ways. Funny stuff. I mean, there's one where somebody is being knighted, and Queen Victoria lowers the sword, and a little too fast, and then you hear this thump off screen, and at the end, these people are credited in order of their disappearance. And that pretty much sets the tone for the kind of comedy that is. We get to the last two people, and they're two brothers, played by the great John Mills and the great Ralph Richardson. Now, one of them is healthy, one's not, one's scheming and crafty, and the other one is pretty much blissfully ignorant, and it wouldn't even occur to him to be anything but benevolent to everyone. Well, the nice one has bad children, and the bad one has nice children, and they're really more interested than anybody in the money, because whoever's left surviving isn't going to get to enjoy it very long. They're both old. So there's all kinds of scheming to keep one of these two brothers alive and kill off the other one. Well, this is an insane series of misunderstandings happen, and everybody thinks the wrong person has died, and so they try to scheme to say, all right, well, this one died first, so I get the money, all this crazy stuff. Well, if it doesn't sound funny, I don't know what is. This is one of my all-time favorite comedies. It's crazy, quirky, and demented, and it's got a mix of comedic styles to it. It's pretty great, because on the one hand, you have these outrageous, over-the-top sight gags, and on the other, there's some one-liners that are played so straight, you're just going to miss them if you're not paying attention. Great cast. The two I already mentioned, Michael Caine is in this, Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, Peter Sellers, and Peter Graves, the Peter trilogy, I guess. And many of them portray characters that you know, the characters themselves would sustain another film, but they're all here together to interact in all kinds of interesting ways. A lot of fun. Not really well known, though, but maybe in England it's a little more appreciated, because it does have a kind of British sensibility to it.
Wow, that sounds fantastic, Sam, I gotta say. Is it on DVD?
It's not available on DVD, so we should all do a letter-writing campaign to all 12 of these movies that are not on DVD yet, because they need to be put on.
All of mine actually are on DVD. So.
Ah, well, all right, six.
There you go. Okay, so we're gonna write Criterion and tell them that they need to release your list.
Right.
Maybe we should just bypass the Criterion collection. We could have the Stoddard collection.
Ooh.
Obscure movies from the 40s and 50s. I think we got some money-making idea there.
Okay.
All right, well, let's recap. My top six movies that I like that people just haven't seemed to heard of. Number six is Mumford from 1999 by Larry Kasdan. Number five, Mute Witness from 1994 by director Anthony Walker. Number four, Spartan, 2004 by David Mamet. Number three, Cachet from 2005 by Michael Haneke. Number two, Primer from 2004 by Shane Carruth, which I've talked about a lot before. And number one, The Stuntman from 1980 by director Richard Rush.
And my number six is Make Mine Mink from 1960, starring Terry Thomas and a number of other great British comedians from that time. Number five, Wonder Man, Danny Kaye from 1945. Number four, The Unsuspected from 1947. Number three, The Captive Heart, the prisoner of war camp movie from 1946. Number two, It Started with Eve. I think that one is on DVD. And that's from 1941, starring Deanna Durbin. And probably most of the other movies of hers that are available are worth seeing, too. Number one, The Wrong Box from 1966. You can maybe get them used on VHS if you're desperate, or maybe you just watch TCM and AMC and watch for them there. This week I got a pretty common trivia question for you. This gets asked a lot in trivia quizzes, and it's about the Marx Brothers that we'll be talking about a little later in the show. The question is, who is the fifth Marx Brother? There's Groucho, Harpo, Chico, Zeppo, and there's one more. If you know what it is, raise your hand and say, oh, 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 until I call on you in about 45 minutes.
Well, this week we're continuing our industry trend look at censorship and ratings of motion pictures in America. And remember last time we just concluded around 1934 or so when the Production Code Authority was established. And the Production Code, this list of things that you couldn't do in a studio movie, was firmly entrenched. So, of course, now we're going to jump backwards just a little tiny bit to talk more about the legal system and how it is going to be viewing art and expression. The first thing we talked about last week was how the First Amendment didn't originally apply to the states and also to film. In 1915, the Supreme Court had issued a decision saying that essentially, you know, this First Amendment's freedom of speech didn't apply to movies because they were business. And not only that, but it wouldn't have applied to state censorship of movies anyway because the First Amendment didn't apply to the states. Well, that was in 1915. 10 years later, the Supreme Court is going to start applying the First Amendment to the states, essentially saying that not just Congress, but also states and by extension cities and counties cannot abridge the freedom of speech of their citizens either. So that's in 1925. And now flashing forward a bit to 1952, the Supreme Court issues another real landmark decision in terms of movie censorship, and a decision called Joseph Burstyn versus Wilson. In 1952, the Supreme Court strikes down a New York state law that banned sacrilegious films. Essentially, the New York state legislature had said, well, you need a license to show movies, and you can't get this license if you're going to show any sacrilegious movies. Well, the Supreme Court makes it very clear that movies get First Amendment protections, and they explicitly, in fact, reverse their 1915 decision, arguing that since that decision came before the incorporation of the First Amendment to states, that it was no longer really applicable, but since now we're applying the First Amendment to states, that movies are going to get First Amendment protection. And this is, in fact, part of an overall trend that we're going to see with the Supreme Court and speech rulings in America, in which the Supreme Court is going to embrace lots more than just printed material and spoken words as being protected by freedom of speech. You know, movies are going to fall under that, plays, all sorts of stuff that wasn't for a long time considered. For a long time, freedom of speech was pretty narrow and to the point where even symbolic acts are considered protected speech. You know, today, for instance, flag burning is considered free speech. Certainly wouldn't have been 100 years ago. But this is going to pretty much put kind of a new context on things in the early 50s. Because the courts are also going to basically tell states that they can't censor things as much as they used to want to. The production code, so we'll go back to there, the production code in the 1930s is going to really get rid of a lot of these local censorship boards that had existed, because the studios adhere to it, and they're pretty stringent about it, so a lot of the states don't need to create any kind of real censorship boards anymore. So the studios were largely effective in curtailing that threat. But also, sort of at the same time, the courts are going to make it harder and harder for states to have censorship boards, because those censorship boards are not going to be allowed to, you know, attack as many things. In general, the obscenity requirements are going to be loosened significantly, and this gets a little technical, but obscenity, which essentially you can mainly translate to pornography, obscenity is not protected speech, but what constitutes obscenity is going to be this weird moving target starting in the 1950s up through the 70s and 80s, really, but it's going to be harder and harder to ban things just by calling them obscene, and as we see in 1952, the fact that it offends your religious sensibilities is explicitly not going to be allowed. You cannot ban a movie just because you don't like what it says about morals or religion. And so this is, again, part of a broader sort of change after World War II in the 1940s. American society is going through this kind of weird period in the 1950s where it's trying to figure things out, and obviously by the 1960s, there's going to be this huge sort of cultural shift in American society. And so we kind of start seeing this in movies in the late 50s, somewhere even to the mid-50s. Remember we talked about in our industry trend on the studio system that the studios lose control of the movie theaters in 1948. You know, the Supreme Court says you can't both own a movie production company and a movie distribution company and a movie exhibition company. So they lose control over what movies get shown. And this is 1948, so in the early 1950s, foreign films are going to be shown in movie theaters, and these foreign films may or may not receive production code approval. And this is, you know, going to create a bit of a problem for the studios, because a lot of other countries have much less stringent requirements on what are allowed to be shown, and so, especially in the art houses that began cropping up in the big cities, they're showing foreign films that American studios would never be able to release under the production code. But not only that, but, I mean, it sort of shows this idea that there can be some profitable movies that do not fall into this production code. And this becomes even more clear with a guy named Otto Preminger, a director who works kind of as an independent producer and director within the American studio system. He's going to work for studios, but he's kind of a bit of a rebel, and he really sort of enjoys attacking the studio system where he can. And in 1953, he makes a film called The Moon is Blue, a famous film because of its controversy, and it's a comedy about seduction, about a man trying to seduce a young woman. And this is explicitly barred by the production code, which says you cannot treat... I mean, look, you shouldn't show seduction, period, and if you do, it shouldn't be the object of comedy. Well, Preminger and United Artists, the studio that produced it, go ahead and release the film anyway, even though it doesn't receive the production code authority's seal of approval. Now, it's not released, you know, into, like, gigantic wide release all over the country, but it's a success, because it's kind of released limited into some theaters, and it's critically well-received, and it makes money. So this tells at least one studio, United Artists, that it's possible to make movies that make money that don't have approval of the production code. And just 2 years later, Preminger is once again kind of pushing the envelope with a film called The Man with the Golden Arm, based on a novel of the same name. And it's a film about drug addiction, and it's a pretty well-respected film, but the production code doesn't let you show drugs, so how do you make a movie about a drug addict? Well, Preminger is like, you know, he doesn't care about the code that much. He wants to go out of his way to break it. And he's aided in a weird way here by the new head of the Production Code Authority. Breen retires right about this time. Remember we talked about the guy who had sort of was the first guy behind the Production Code Authority who really gave it some teeth. And he retires and is replaced by a guy named Jeffrey Sherlock, who kind of feels that the production code is a little outmoded. And this guy, Sherlock, who's now running the Production Code Authority, works with Preminger to create the Man with the Golden Arm as a test case to try and revise the production code, specifically about drugs. They kind of go out of their way, Preminger and Sherlock, to create a script that will be acceptable to the code in every way except for the fact that it shows the people using drugs, to try and make a case that we should change the code, at least as it relates to drug use, because we should be able to make movies that deal with drug use, because it's, you know, in the 1950s, it's an important issue in American society.
Yeah, and I have to say, The Man with the Golden Arm is just really good about, I mean, you think of some older drug movies like Reefer Madness or just
right.
nonsense, but The Man with the Golden Arm, which comes, you know, quite a bit later on in history, but is a very, very interesting portrait of drug addiction, and you'd think they'd be quite happy to have it because it does, I mean, you don't want to go out and do drugs after seeing the movie
right.
at all.
Right. Well, the other thing that happens that actually upsets, and this is, the film gets in, becomes a sort of political hot potato, is that the United States drug czar gets wind of it and is upset that they've changed the ending of the novel. At the end of the novel, the protagonist kills himself because he can't kick his drug addiction. Well, the movie has a little bit of a happier ending. They changed it from the novel, and the drug czar is concerned that will make people think it's okay to do drugs, which, you know, bizarre. Obviously, he was protesting before the movie's even been released or finished, so he hasn't even seen it. He's just read about it, and anyway, it becomes a big issue to the point that Sherlock's deal with Preminger kind of falls apart. The other big studios catch wind that United Artists is going to be willing to release this movie even without the Production Code Authority's approval again, and the studios just block it. They won't allow any revision to the production code, and it creates a huge rift within the studio system, to the point that United Artists actually leaves the agency, the MPA at this time. And so they decide, well, look, screw it, we're going to release this movie anyway without production code approval. And they do it, and this also marks the very first time that the National Legion of Decency goes ahead and okays a film. They say this is an okay movie for you to go and see, even if it doesn't have a production code certificate of approval. And this was because the National Legion for Decency was concerned that people thought that it and the Production Code Authority were in cahoots, so it's going to go ahead and go against the Production Code Authority in this case. So the movie doesn't have a certificate, it's released, and because it has the okay of this National League for Decency, which is this huge lobbyist group, the big theaters, including the Lowe's chain, show it. And it makes a ton of money, and everyone can go see it, and it's playing everywhere. And this is the first time since 1934 that a major studio production is released without the approval of the PCA, and it also just becomes a huge hit. So it's being released by a studio, and the studios decide, okay, look, we have to go ahead and revise the code. So they do that in 1956, but honestly, pretty much everyone involved thought it was still too conservative. They're going to allow the depiction of drugs, and Fox is going to be able to release a movie called A Hat Full of Rain very shortly thereafter, which is all about drug use, but it's probably still not enough. And so it's going to lead to more studios just releasing films without the approval of the Production Code Authority. Now, not necessarily the major studios are going to do it. It's going to be but there are going to be some major productions that are going to be released without Production Code Authority. The Billy Wilder film Some Like It Hot, starring Marilyn Monroe and Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis in 1959, is released without a certificate. And Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960 is also released without approval of the Production Code Authority because of its violent themes. And so, you know, these are both huge hits, big, giant movies with movie stars in them. And they don't have approval of the production code, and they're not boycotted or banned, and so this is going to set up the 1960s, which we'll get to in the next segment, where the industry is going to undergo a real monumental shift, revising this sort of failing and dying off system.
Africa is God's country, and he can have it. Well, sir, we left New York drunk and early on the morning of February the 2nd. After 15 days on the water and 6 on the boat, we finally arrived at the shores of Africa. We at once proceeded 300 miles into the heart of the jungle, where I shot a polar bear. Well, the bear was anemic, and he couldn't stand the cold climate. One morning, I was sitting in front of the cabin smoking some meat. There wasn't a cigar store in the neighborhood. As I say, I was sitting in front of the cabin when I bagged 6 tigers. I begged them to go away, but they hung around all afternoon. One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know. Then we tried to remove the tusks, but they were embedded in so firmly that we couldn't budge them. Of course, in Alabama, the Tuscaloosa. But that's entirely irrelevant to what I was talking about. We took some pictures of the native girls, but they weren't developed. But we're going back again in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, that's my clumsy delivery of a Groucho Marx monologue, and it really makes me regret not picking Groucho Marx for my top six actors for monologues several weeks ago. Gosh, the Marx Brothers, we want to talk about... It's one of the most popular comedy teams of, well, the 20s in theater, but in film, then all the way through the 40s. There were five of them, Groucho, Harpo, Chico, Zeppo, and if you think I'm giving away the answer to the trivia question, you're mistaken, but there was a fifth. Anyway, they were born in New York City to Jewish immigrants from Germany, and originally they were musicians, and they had these musical acts that they had, and they showed an early aptitude for music, and their parents nurtured that talent, and eventually, you know, they went into vaudeville, and that was the thing to do at the time if you were entertainers of that nature, go into vaudeville. Chico, and it is Chico, not Chico, which I probably had just said incorrectly earlier, but he was a natural on the piano. His playing style is entertaining just to watch. It's very theatrical and comic and entertaining. He would typically kind of shoot the high notes as if he were, you know, it would make his finger into a gun and just shoot away at the high notes like that. It's very theatrical playing. And Harpo was good on the piano with only two particular songs, though. Otherwise, he was pretty useless with it. Couldn't pick up the guitar either, but then he discovered the harp, and he became dedicated to it and taught himself how to play it. Actually, years later, he discovered he taught himself to play the harp the wrong way. There's some techniques he used that are, you know, considered bad habits, and yet he was just so good that established harpists of his day sought him out to learn from him and become better. He's a brilliant player, and so I want to talk about this music angle, first of all, because the movies do feature a lot of music in them, and in particular, most of the movies feature one piano solo with Chico and another harp solo with Harpo, and gosh, I'm not a huge fan of musical interludes in comedies. I love musicals, but these two guys are just amazing to watch. But that was later. Early on, they were trying to get a musical act going, and there was this evolution as to who was in the act and what they did with it. All five Marx Brothers actually never performed together. It was always this rotating group membership that they had in their act. But as the story goes, in 1912, they were performing out in Texas, and the performance was interrupted by a lot of commotion from outside, from a runaway mule. That's just the greatest distraction ever, I think. Only in Texas. Anyway, a large portion of the audience just ran outside to see what was going on, and then they filtered back in, and Groucho was livid. He just went ballistic on them and started improvising these put-downs and started insulting the audience and making fun of Texas and everything. Well, the audience cracked up. They loved it. And so that got them thinking, hey, maybe we've really got a comedy act here. And so eventually their act sort of evolved into a musical comedy act with more and more comedy and less music. And eventually they made it to Broadway and became a smash hit there as the first ever comedy act to play on Broadway. So really incredible beginnings before the movies ever entered the picture. And eventually they did land that film deal, and they made The Coconuts in 1929, and it was a smash hit. Pretty dated today, actually. It's one of these early sound films. The technical work is all a little awkward. They had to do some strange things, like every time you see a piece of paper, it's actually sopping wet because it was the only way they could keep the paper from crinkling and the microphone picking up that sound. But certainly by their next film, Animal Crackers, which is where that monologue came from that I quoted at the beginning, they've hit their stride and the template for the Marx Brothers film is established. And it didn't really change much either. 13 films in 20 years, they're all basically cut from the same cloth. The situations change, the jokes change, the names of the characters change, but the dynamics remain the same. So, let's talk a bit about their characters and their senses of humor. Steven, I understood that you actually just saw one of them recently.
Yeah, I just watched Horse Feathers last week. You know, I mean, I think the thing about the Marx Brothers is, obviously they're very funny, but it's definitely a different style of humor that we're not used to today. I mean, it definitely has that vaudevillian roots in it. You can see how it has all the roots of screwball in it, and you know all the plays on words and the sort of the frantically paced visual gags, but it's so very different from what we think of as being comedy today. It's kind of really an interesting look back at the way we used to really think of comedy in America and that kind of thing. I mean, obviously it's a great film, but I just think, you know, when we talk about them, it's not the same kind of humor as we'd see today.
Yeah, it isn't. In fact, although it does definitely have its vaudeville roots are very evident, it's kind of sketch-based. You get this whole story, but if you really kind of break down the elements to the story, it's really just a series of sketches that happen to have the same theme going on. So in that sense, it's very vaudevillian. But I would say that it was even out of place then, because the Marx Brothers were doing a couple of things that nobody else was doing at that time. And number one, they were very anti-establishment and anarchic kind of humor. Their take on everything was just complete anarchy. Everything was fair game. Obviously, the establishment is a common target of comedy, whether it's government, business, or respected individuals, but not so much, actually, at the time they were making these movies. So they're sort of forerunners of this kind of irreverent style of comedy that we're quite familiar with today. But they also make fun of each other, themselves, you know, other people, anybody and everything. And that, I think, allowed them to be insulting without really causing a lot of offense that really would have offended a lot of people at the time because, as I say, they weren't used to this kind of irreverent style of humor. And so a lot of the humor, I think, would have been quite scandalous, but they get away with it. And, you know, they're really only interested in getting a laugh anyway. I don't think they're too serious in trying to put everybody down. That's just, you know, that's how you get humor. You make things look silly. And really chaotic and surreal humor as well. I mean, you get these, the monologue that I quoted maybe illustrates this to a point. You get this fast-paced dialogue or monologue where one joke kind of bleeds into another and you're laughing at one, but he's already, especially Groucho was very good at this, he had already told two more jokes. And with each step, it makes less and less sense in the context of the movie, but they go for it anyway. Groucho, he could improvise, actually. He had a game show later on, You Bet Your Life, where he would interview the guests on the quiz show. It was on radio and on television. And he didn't know them ahead of time, but he improvised his dialogue with them. And he was just as good as if it was scripted in a movie. In fact, some people say it was scripted, but it really wasn't. Anyway, in the movies, he's usually sparring with a straight woman named Margaret Dumont, the actress Margaret Dumont, who was in a bunch of the movies. Groucho said she made such a great foil, comic foil, because she didn't really get his jokes. You know, often there'd be a scene where Groucho just kind of half woos Dumont and half mocks her at the same time. But it'll go on and on and on, and it'll all kind of go right over her head, I mean, the character's head. And it'll lose the narrative, but it doesn't really matter because the laughs are coming on so fast and furious, and definitely a lot of wordplay. So yeah, really anarchic kind of humor there, and I think that's one of the things that makes it, although it's dated humor, again, not so dated as you think it would be. Maybe other people trying the same thing, because it really is clever stuff. So let's just talk briefly about the characters. I talked a lot about Groucho. He would be the one doing all the verbal humor, mostly. But his appearance, and that's where the surreal thing kind of comes in. He always has these fake, bushy eyebrows and this hilariously huge grease paint mustache. And, you know, how surreal can you get? No matter who he's playing, he's got this thick black mustache painted on and no explanation ever. The movies sort of acknowledge it. Like one time, one of the other Marx Brothers disguises himself as Groucho and he puts on a slab of grease paint mustache. And so, you know, they're kind of acknowledging that this is not a real mustache, but never any explanation for why it's there. His characters are usually doctors or professors. Really super respected professions that lent themselves to these comic situations because, you know, number one, by acting completely crazy, you could sort of make fun of that whole reverence we have for these professions. But more importantly, it allowed his character to be accepted by these straight characters in the movie, and so he would be hired, invited to speak or whatever. In Duck Soup, he's actually enlisted to be the ruler of a small nation that this rich woman is bailing out of bankruptcy. In Horse Feathers, he's a professor. And so anyway, he's always being hired or invited to speak at these public functions or whatever, and then he can use those situations for comedy by just completely messing them up and acting all lunatic. So that was Groucho. Harpo and Chico, they were almost always friends, their characters in the movie, and they kind of had each other as their comic foils. Harpo had this curly blonde wig, and he never spoke. He could speak. He wasn't actually mute, but he never did in the movies. He'd have this horn that he'd honk, this old-fashioned car horn, or he'd blow a whistle or something like that instead. He was very, very talented at doing comedy through pantomime. And that lent itself to some good routines with Chico, where he'd try to tell him something with hand gestures, basically play charades, and Chico would try to guess what he was saying using these hilariously crazy leaps of logic. So that was another instance where the real verbal humor comes into play here. And as for Chico, he had this Italian persona. He would put on this Italian accent and usually play a con artist or something like that. But again, we have this situation where it's sort of an act within an act, because Chico's actual characters weren't really Italian. He would just speak like an Italian. So nothing is really real in a Marx Brothers movie, I guess, is the message. It's just there to set up these incredible sequence of jokes. The fourth Marx Brother to appear in the movies, the fifth never did appear in a movie. The fourth one would be Zeppo. Strange thing about Zeppo, the Marx Brothers generally agreed that Zeppo was the funniest one off stage and off screen, but his persona in the movies was as the romantic lead and more or less a straight man. There's sort of two camps about Zeppo. One is that he was pretty bland and he left the movies after the first five and he wasn't really missed after that. There's another camp that holds to Zeppo being an important comic element and one that was really, really subtle, especially compared, with Groucho being not subtle at all, really, except he'd slip jokes by people, but not quite the same thing. Zeppo was, the idea is not that he's just a conventional romantic leading man, but an exaggeratedly conventional romantic leading man, so far over the top sappy and wooden that it's quite on purpose. And a lot of ink has been spilt writing about him. A great line was written by Alan W. Ellis, just a quote I randomly ran across. "The sense in the nonsense only compounds the nonsense." So in other words, Zeppo being in there is an oddball because he's the one normal guy. It just makes everything that much more silly or seem that way. There's another thing, too. There's a scene in Animal Crackers that I kind of really like where Groucho is dictating a letter to Zeppo, and Zeppo slips in these little jabs. Like Groucho would clear his throat, and Zeppo asks, "Do you want that in the letter?" Of course, Groucho would have a comeback with that. But eventually what he ends up doing is only taking down the salutation and leaving the rest out because it didn't sound important. So that's sort of the dynamic of the Marx Brothers. Just really quickly go through their films. They made five at Paramount right in the beginning. The Coconuts, Animal Crackers, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, and Duck Soup. All but the Coconuts are probably real classics. Definitely Horse Feathers and Duck Soup. You can start with either one of those, and Animal Crackers and Monkey Business are also pretty brilliant. And they, at Paramount, they had a lot of freedom to do their thing. They were just immensely popular, and so the studio didn't feel a whole lot of need to put pressure on how they would make their movies. They were allowed to do what they wanted to, until Duck Soup, which is weird because most people think it's the best Marx Brothers film, but it flopped at the time. And I think one of the reasons is they kind of got a sense that their verbal humor was working so much better than their slapstick kind of thing. There's a lot of slapstick in some of it, even though it's mostly a verbal comedy style. And they kind of toned that down because it wasn't as good. And maybe that was one of the reasons Duck Soup didn't do too well at the time. I don't know. It might have been they lessened the romantic subplot kind of thing that you usually have. But so then they changed studios to MGM, and MGM said, "All right, well, we're gonna finance your movies, but we're gonna have to make some changes." And one of them was to make things a little more slapsticky again. Another one was to enhance the romantic subplot angle and kind of relegate the Marx Brothers themselves to more supporting roles. This is a terrible, terrible series of decisions. Nevertheless, the first one they made for MGM was A Night at the Opera, and it was also brilliant. So probably that one is also one of the ones that you could start with as being just one of the best. And after that, most of them are good, but they're sort of gradually decline. A Day at the Races, Room Service, At the Circus, Go West, and those are all very good or quite good.
then the big store in 1941, and that, I think, is a huge step down. It's definitely, they're losing their edge at this point. They pick it back up a little bit for A Night in Casablanca in 1946, and then they lose it again in Love Happy in 49 or 50, depending on who you ask. But that's the 13 movies, and you really, you know, even the two bad ones are not that bad. I mean, they still have some genius in them. I just wouldn't recommend starting with them. But you can plunge in anywhere, and gosh, I guarantee you, funny stuff. It's really intelligent humor too. Like I said, you got these crazy monologues that just go on, or a dialogue series. There's a scene in one of them where Groucho is trying to romance Margaret Dumont, I think, and slipping in all these little insults amidst his wooing, and then another woman shows on the scene and he starts doing the same thing to her. So basically he's hitting on two women in front of each other and also kind of insulting them and himself at the same time. I mean, who can do that and get away with it? It's just crazy stuff. Was that reflective of kind of what you were thinking when you were watching Horse Feathers, Stephen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's definitely true. I like the way you mentioned that there's this weird kind of mix of intellectual humor in addition to all this crazy slapstick kind of lowbrow stuff. I mean, just an example, in Horse Feathers, it's about these two competing colleges, and one is named Huxley and the other is named Darwin, which is a clever gag only if you happen to be particularly familiar with 19th century scientists and biology disputes at the time. But I mean, you know, because Huxley was actually an ardent defender of Darwin's theory in the 19th century. But I mean, that's a kind of weird gag that you wouldn't expect, and also in a movie that features an extended sequence of football pratfalls as its climax. So, definitely kind of cool, clever dichotomy. And, everything you said about Groucho is dead on. I think for most people, he's probably the real lasting attraction, is just his ridiculously funny lines and perfect delivery of them. Just wonderful stuff.
Yeah, he really is. And, you know, I think one of the reasons that we remember the Marx Brothers now is there's nobody else, well, I said this before, but there really is nobody else that was doing this kind of thing. I can watch a Charlie Chaplin film and then watch a Harold Lloyd film and say, okay, these are different. They're different geniuses, but you can sort of see how they came out of the same era. Maybe one even influenced the other to an extent, I don't know, and move on. Look at the comedy teams of the 50s. You get Abbott and Costello and Martin and Lewis, and you can kind of see that, yes, okay, they're very different, but you get a sense of them belonging at this time in Hollywood history. And then you get the Marx Brothers that it's really only the peripheral things that date them. You know, you got the, I mean, if you see a car in a Marx Brothers movie, okay, you can date it. But really, they're not like anybody else. They're just kind of there. It's like aliens came down and made Marx Brothers movies. But the people who love Marx Brothers movies really love them. It's not just another thing to go watch. The people who love them tend to be rather fanatical about them, and I go through phases where I just want to watch them all over again, you know. But really great comics and worth checking out, especially if you've never seen any of them before. You could start with Horse Feathers or Duck Soup or probably A Night at the Opera as well. Animal Crackers even. So, yeah, there's four titles that you could go find. Actually, I think Netflix has them all. And it even has Horse Feathers that you can watch online if you signed up for the Watch Now feature, the instant watching thing. So you can catch that immediately. You can impulse buy that one if you have a Netflix account already.
Welcome back to the trivia question part of our show, where we have a question. It's, who is the fifth Marx brother? There were five brothers. Actually, there were six, if you count one that died in infancy. But basically, five performing Marx brothers. And we mentioned Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Zeppo, who are the four better-known ones. But there is a fifth. Do you know who that is, Stephen?
You know, I know this. It's no one ever remembers this guy, but I'm going to get it's Doc, right? Doc.
I
always forget Doc.
Not quite. That would be the Seven Dwarves, not five Marx Brothers.
Right.
It's confusing, you know, because they both have numbers in their group act. No, the fifth Marx Brother was called Gummo. And you probably don't know him because he never appeared on film. He was part of the earlier stage act, and then he was drafted into the army during World War I. But he was tired of performing anyhow. They say he probably would have quit even if he had not been drafted, and so he never returned to it. Instead, after leaving the army, he eventually partnered up with his brother Zeppo right when he was leaving the movies, and they ran a theatrical agency together. But, you know, even on stage, there was never a time when all five Marx brothers performed together. It was usually just three or four, just a different three or four. So now that you know a little bit about Gummo, you can appreciate a sneaky insider joke in the Woody Allen film Stardust Memories. If you ever see that funny scene, it's just brought to mind when I was looking at this. This scholarly woman at a film festival is said to have written the definitive filmography of Gummo Marx. Probably didn't use much paper to do it, though. That wraps up episode 40. We have no more for you today except a few closing words, but we've got tons of things for you on the website, allmovietalk.com. I don't know if you know this, every episode has show notes for it, so if you want more information about the segments we cover, you can go there and maybe get a different perspective, and we also post different things throughout the week. Hey, a blooper, you know, what we mess up while we're recording. Well, we have usually a weekly series of posts about what's going on in the 1920s in Hollywood. Check those out. And also check out rankworks.com, rankworks.com.
And next week, of course, we'll finish up talking about ratings and censorship. But also I'm excited because we'll be talking about the Coen brothers, director spotlight on them, two guys that, if you listen to the show at all, you know both Sam and I love. And our top six list for next week will focus on the top six films noir, those great dark movies from especially the 40s and 50s, but also some more modern ones as well. So if you're interested in picking up some great noir flicks to check out, be sure to check us back next week with episode 41.
One time I said cut in my pajamas. How I said it in my pajamas, I'll never know.